Side 2. The Stars, My Destination. Continuing on page 41. Three pristine V-class transports, Vega, Vestal, and Vorga, stood partially raised near the center of the yards, undergoing flaking and replating, as the heat-lightning flicker of torches around Vorga indicated. At the concrete building marked Entry, the pristine entourage stopped before a sign that read, "You are endangering your life if you enter these premises unlawfully. You have been warned." Visitor badges were distributed to the party, and even Pristine of Pristine received a badge. He dutifully pinned it on, for he well knew what the result of entry without such a protective badge would be. The entourage continued, winding its way through pits until it arrived at 0-3, where the pit mouth was decorated with bunting in the pristine colors, and a small grandstand had been erected. Pristine was welcomed, and in turn greeted his various officials. The pristine band struck up the clan song, bright and brassy, but one of the instruments appeared to have gone insane. It struck a brazen note that blared louder and louder until it engulfed the entire band and the surprised exclamations. Only then did Pristine realize that it was not an instrument sounding, but the shipyard alarm. An intruder was in the yard, someone not wearing an identification or visitor's badge. The radar field of the protection system was tripped, and the alarm sounded. Through the raucous bellow of the alarm, Pristine could hear a multitude of pops as the yard guards jaunted from the grandstand and took positions around the square mile of concrete field. His own jaunt watch closed in around him, looking wary and alert. A voice began blaring on the PA coordinating defense. "Unknown in yard. Unknown in yard at E for Edward 9. E for Edward 9 moving west on foot."
"Someone must have broken in,"
Blackrod shouted.
"I'm aware of that," Pristine answered calmly.
"He must be a stranger if he's not jaunting in here."
"I'm aware of that also."
"Unknown approaching D for David 5, D for David 5, still on foot. D for David 5 alert."
"What in God's name is he up to?"
Blackrod exclaimed.
"You are aware of my rule, sir?" Pristine said coldly. "No associate of the Pristine clan may take the name of the divinity in vain. You forget yourself."
"Unknown now approaching C for Charlie 5. Now approaching C for Charlie 5.
Blackrod touched Pristine's arm. "He's coming this way, Pristine. Will you take cover, please?"
"I will not."
"Pristine, there have been assassination attempts before. Three of them, if..."
"How do I get to the top of this stand?"
"Pristine!"
"Help me up."
Aided by Blackrod, still protesting hysterically, Pristine climbed to the top of the grandstand to watch the power of the Pristine clan in action against danger. Below, he could see workmen in white jumpers swarming out of the pits to watch the excitement. Guards were appearing as they jaunted from distant sectors toward the focal point of the action.
"Unknown moving south toward B for Baker 3. B for Baker 3.
Pristine watched the B-3 pit. A figure appeared, dashing swiftly toward the pit, veering, dodging, bullying forward. It was a giant man in hospital blues with a wild thatch of black hair and a distorted face that appeared in the distance to be painted in livid colors. His clothes were flickering like heat lightning as the protective induction field of the defense system seared him.
"B for Baker 3, alert. B for Baker 3, close in."
There were shouts and a distant rattle of shots, the pneumatic whine of scope guns. Half a dozen workmen in white leaped for the intruder. He scattered them like ninepins and drove on and on toward B-3 where the nose of Vorga showed. He was a lightning bolt driving through workmen and guards, pivoting, bludgeoning, boring forward implacably. Suddenly he stopped, reached inside his flaming jacket and withdrew a black canister. With a convulsive gesture of an animal writhing in death throes, he bit the end of the canister and hurled it straight and true on a high arc toward Vorga. The next instant, he was struck down.
"Explosive! Take cover! Explosive! Take cover! Cover!"
"Pristine!"
Blackrod squawked. Pristine shook him off and watched the canister curve up and then down toward the nose of Vorga, spinning and glinting in the cold sunlight. At the edge of the pit, it was caught by the anti-grav beam and flicked upwards as by a giant invisible thumbnail. Up and up and up it whirled, 100, 500, 1,000 feet. Then there was a blinding flash, and an instant later a titanic clap of thunder that smote ears and jarred teeth and bone. Pristine picked himself up and descended the grandstand to the launching podium. He placed his finger on the launching button of the Pristine Princess.
"Bring me that man, if he's still alive," he said to Blackrod.
He pressed the button.
"I christen thee the Pristine Power,"
he called in triumph. Chapter 4. The Star Chamber in Castle Pristine was an oval room with ivory panels picked out with gold high mirrors and stained glass windows. It contained a gold organ with robot organist by Tiffany, a gold-tooled library with android librarian on library ladder, a Louis XV desk with android secretary before a manual memo bead recorder, an American bar with robot bartender. Pristine would have preferred human servants, but androids and robots kept secrets.
"Be seated, Captain Yeovil," he said courteously. "This is Mr. Regis Sheffield, representing me in this matter. That young man is Mr. Sheffield's assistant."
"Bunny is my portable law library," Sheffield grunted.
Pristine touched a control. The still life in the Star Chamber came alive. The organist played, the librarian sorted books, the secretary typed. The bartender shook drinks. It was spectacular, and the impact, carefully calculated by industrial psychometrists, established control for Pristine and put visitors at a disadvantage.
"You spoke of a man named Foyle, Captain Yeovil?"
Pristine prompted. Captain Peter Yang Yeovil of Central Intelligence was a lineal descendant of the learned Mencius, and belonged to the intelligence tong of the inner planet's armed forces. For 200 years, the IPAF had entrusted its intelligence work to the Chinese, who, with a 5,000-year history of cultivated subtlety behind them, had achieved wonders. Captain Yang Yeovil was a member of the dreaded Society of Paper Men, an adept of the Tenzin image makers, a master of superstition, and fluent in the secret speech. He did not look Chinese. Yang Yeovil hesitated, fully aware of the psychological pressures operating against him. He examined Pristine's ascetic basilisk face, Sheffield's blunt, aggressive expression, and the eager young man named Bunny, whose rabbit features had an unmistakable Oriental cast. It was necessary for Yeovil to re-establish control or effect a compromise. He opened with a flanking movement.
"Are we related anywhere within 15 degrees of consanguinity?" he asked Bunny in the Mandarin dialect.
"I am of the house of the learned Meng Zhe, whom the barbarians called Mencius."
"Then we are hereditary enemies," Bunny answered in faltering Mandarin, "for the formidable ancestor of my line was deposed as governor of Shandong in 342 B.C. by the earth pig Meng Zhe."
"With all courtesy, I shave your ill-formed eyebrows," Yang Yeovil said.
"Most respectfully, I singe your snaggled teeth," Bunny laughed.
"Come, sirs," Pristine protested. "We are reaffirming a 3,000-year blood feud," Yang Yeovil explained to Pristine, who looked sufficiently unsettled by the conversation and the laughter, which he did not understand. He tried a direct thrust. "When will you be finished with Foyle?" he asked.
"What Foyle?" Sheffield cut in.
"What Foyle have you got?"
"There are 13 of that name associated with the Clan Pristine."
"An interesting number. Did you know I was a master of superstition? Some day I must show you the mirror and listen mystery. I refer to the Foyle involved in a reported attempt on Mr. Pristine's life this morning."
"Pristine," Pristine corrected. "I am not Mr. I am Pristine of Pristine."
"Three attempts have been made on Pristine's life," Sheffield said. "You'll have to be more specific."
"Three this morning? Pristine must have been busy."
Yang Yeovil sighed. Sheffield was proving himself a resolute opponent. The intelligence man tried another diversion.
I do wish our Mr. Presto had been more specific.
Your Mr. Presto?
Pristine exclaimed.
Oh, yes. Didn't you know one of your 500 Prestos was an agent of ours?
That's odd. We took it for granted you'd find out, and went ahead with the confusion operation.
Pristine looked appalled. Yang Yovel crossed his legs and continued to chat breezily.
That's the basic weakness in routine intelligence procedure. You start finessing before finesse is required.
He's bluffing, Pristine burst out. None of our Prestos could possibly have any knowledge of Gulliver Foyle.
Thank you, Yang Yovel smiled. That's the Foyle I want. When can you let us have him? Sheffield scowled at Pristine and then turned on Yang Yovel.
Who's us? He demanded.
Central Intelligence.
Why do you want him?
Do you make love to a woman before or after you take your clothes off?
That's a damned impertinent question to ask.
And so is yours.
When can you let us have Foyle? When you show cause.
To whom?
To me. Sheffield hammered a heavy forefinger against his palm. This is a civilian matter concerning civilians. Unless war material, war personnel, or the strategy and tactics of a war in being are involved, civilian jurisdiction shall always prevail. 303 Terran Appeals 191, murmured Bunny.
The Nomad was carrying war material?
The Nomad was transporting platinum bullion to Mars Bank, Pristine snapped. If money is a...
I am leading this discussion, Sheffield interrupted. He swung around on Yang Yovel. Name the war material.
This blunt challenge knocked Yang Yovel off balance. He knew that the crux of the Nomad situation was the presence on board the ship of 20 pounds of pyre, the total world supply, which was probably irreplaceable now that its discoverer had disappeared. He knew that Sheffield knew that they both knew this. He had assumed that Sheffield would prefer to keep pyre unnamed, and yet here was the challenge to name the unnameable. He attempted to meet bluntness with bluntness.
All right, gentlemen, I'll name it now. The Nomad was transporting 20 pounds of a substance called pyre.
Pristine started. Sheffield silenced him.
What's pyre?
According to our reports from Pristine's Mr. Presto?
Oh, that was bluff.
Yang Yovel laughed and momentarily regained control.
According to intelligence, pyre was developed for Pristine by a man who subsequently disappeared. Pyre is a mish metal, a pyrophore. That's all we know for a fact. But we've had vague reports about it, unbelievable reports from reputable agents. If a fraction of our inferences are correct, pyre could make the difference between a victory and a defeat.
Nonsense. No war material has ever made that much difference.
No. I cite the fission bomb of 1945. I cite the Null-G anti-gravity installations of 2022. Tally's all-field radar trip screen of 2194. Material can often make the difference, especially when there's the chance of the enemy getting it first.
There's no such chance now.
Thank you for admitting the importance of pyre.
I admit nothing. I deny everything.
Central Intelligence is prepared to offer an exchange. A man for a man. The inventor of pyre for Gully Foyle.
You've got him? Sheffield demanded. Then why badger us for Foyle?
Because we've got a corpse,
Yang Yovel flared. The Outer Satellites Command had him on LaSalle for 6 months trying to carve information out of him. We pulled him out with a raid at a cost of 79% casualties. We rescued a corpse. We still don't know if the outer satellites were having a cynical laugh at our expense letting us recapture a body. We still don't know how much they ripped out of him. Pristine sat bolt upright at this. His merciless fingers tapped slowly and sharply.
Damn it! Yang Yovel stormed. Can't you recognize a crisis, Sheffield? We're on a tightrope. What the devil are you doing backing Pristine in this shabby deal? You're the leader of the Liberal Party. Terra's arch-patriot. You're Pristine's political arch-enemy. Sell him out, you fool, before he sells us all out.
Captain Yovel,
Pristine broke in with icy venom.
These expressions cannot be countenanced.
We want and need pyre, Yang Yovel continued. We'll have to investigate that 20 pounds of pyre, rediscover the synthesis, learn to apply it to the war effort. And all this before the OS beats us to the punch, if they haven't already. But Pristine refuses to cooperate. Why? Because he's opposed to the party in power. He wants no military victories for the liberals. He'd rather we lost the war for the sake of politics, because rich men like Pristine never lose. Come to your senses, Sheffield. You've been retained by a traitor. What in God's name are you trying to do? Before Sheffield could answer, there was a discreet tap on the door of the Star Chamber, and Saul Dagenham was ushered in. Time was when Dagenham was one of the inner planet's research wizards, a physicist with inspired intuition, total recall, and a sixth-order computer for a brain. But there was an accident at Tycho Sands, and the fission blast that should have killed him did not. Instead, it turned him dangerously radioactive. It turned him hot. It transformed him into a 24th-century Typhoid Mary. He was paid 25,000 credits a year by the Inner Planet's government to take precautions which they trusted him to carry out. He avoided physical contact with any person for more than 5 minutes per day. He could not occupy any room other than his own for more than 30 minutes a day. Commanded and paid by the IP to isolate himself, Dagenham had abandoned research and built the Colossus of Dagenham Couriers, Incorporated. When Yang Yovel saw the short, blonde cadaver with the leaden skin and death's head smile enter the Star Chamber, he knew he was assured of defeat in this encounter. He was no match for the three men together. He rose at once. "I'm getting an Admiralty order for Foyle," he said. "As far as intelligence is concerned, all negotiations are ended. From now on, it's war." "Captain Yovel is leaving," Pristine called to the jaunt watch officer who had guided Dagenham in. "Please see him out through the maze." Yang Yovel waited until the officer stepped alongside him and bowed. Then, as the man courteously motioned to the door, Yang Yovel looked directly at Pristine, smiled ironically, and disappeared with a faint pop.
"Pristine!" Bunny exclaimed. "He jaunted. This room isn't blind to him. He..."
"Evidently," Pristine said icily. "Inform the master of the household," he instructed the amazed watch officer. "The coordinates of the Star Chamber are no longer secret. They must be changed within 24 hours. And now, Mr. Dagenham..."
"1 minute," Dagenham said. "There's that Admiralty order."
Without apology or explanation, he disappeared too. Pristine raised his eyebrows.
"Another party to the Star Chamber's secret," he murmured. "But at least he had the tact to conceal his knowledge until the secret was out."
Dagenham reappeared.
"No point wasting time going through the motions of the maze," he said. "I've given orders in Washington. They'll hold Yovel up. 2 hours, guaranteed. 3 hours, probably. 4 hours, possible."
"How will they hold him up?" Bunny asked. Dagenham gave him his deadly smile.
"Standard FFCC operation of Dagenham Couriers. Fun, fantasy, confusion, catastrophe. We'll need all 4 hours. Damn. I've disrupted your dolls, Pristine."
The robots were suddenly capering in lunatic fashion as Dagenham's hard radiation penetrated their electronic systems.
"No matter. I'll be on my way."
"Foyle?"
Pristine asked.
"Nothing yet." Dagenham grinned his death's head smile. "He's really unique. I've tried all the standard drugs and routines on him. Nothing. Outside, he's just an ordinary spaceman, if you forget the tattoo on his face. But inside, he's got steel guts. Something's got hold of him, and he won't give."
"What's got hold of him?" Sheffield asked.
"I hope to find out."
"How?"
"Don't ask. You'd be an accessory. Have you got a ship ready, Pristine?"
Pristine nodded.
"I'm not guaranteeing there'll be any nomad for us to find, but we'll have to get a jump on the Navy if there is." "Law ready, Sheffield?"
"Ready. I'm hoping we won't have to use it."
"I'm hoping, too. But again, I'm not guaranteeing." "All right. Stand by for instructions. I'm on my way to crack Foyle."
"Where have you got him?"
Dagenham shook his head.
"This room isn't secure."
he disappeared. He jaunted Cincinnati, New Orleans, Monterey to Mexico City, where he appeared in the psychiatry wing of the giant hospital of the combined Terran universities. Wing was hardly an adequate name for this section, which occupied an entire city in the metropolis, which was the hospital. Diggenham jaunted up to the 43rd floor of the therapy division and looked into the isolated tank where Foyle floated unconscious. He glanced at the distinguished bearded gentleman in attendance.
Hello, Fritz.
Hello, Saul.
Hell of a thing, the head of psychiatry minding a patient for me.
I think we owe you favors, Saul.
You still brooding about Tico Sands, Fritz?
I'm not.
Am I lousing your wing with radiation?
I've had everything shielded.
Ready for the dirty work?
I wish I knew what you were after.
Information.
And you have to turn my therapy department into an inquisition to get it?
That was the idea.
Why not use ordinary drugs?
Tried them already. No good. He's not an ordinary man.
You know this is illegal.
I know. Changed your mind? Want to back out? I can duplicate your equipment for $250,000.
No, Saul. We'll always owe you favors.
Then let's go. Nightmare Theater first.
They trundled the tank down a corridor and into a 100-feet-square padded room. It was one of therapy's bypassed experiments. Nightmare Theater had been an early attempt to shock schizophrenics back into the objective world by rendering the fantasy world into which they were withdrawing uninhabitable. But the shattering and laceration of patients' emotions had proved to be too cruel and dubious a treatment. For Dagenham's sake, the head of psychiatry had dusted off the 3D visual projectors and reconnected all sensory projectors. They decanted Foyle from his tank, gave him a reviving shot, and left him in the middle of the floor. They removed the tank, turned off the lights, and entered the concealed control booth. There they turned on the projectors. Every child in the world imagines that its fantasy world is unique to itself. Psychiatry knows that the joys and terrors of private fantasies are a common heritage shared by all mankind. Fears, guilt, terrors, and shames could be interchanged from one man to the next, and none would notice the difference. The therapy department at Combined Hospital had recorded thousands of emotional tapes and boiled them down to one all-inclusive, all-terrifying performance in Nightmare Theater. Foyle awoke, panting and sweating, and never knew that he had awakened. He was in the clutch of the serpent-haired, bloody-eyed Eumenides. He was pursued, entrapped, precipitated from heights, burned, flayed, bowstringed, vermin-covered, devoured. He screamed, he ran. The radar hobble field in the theater clogged his steps and turned them into the ghastly slow motion of dream running. And through the cacophony of grinding, shrieking, moaning, pursuing that assailed his ears, muttered the thread of a persistent voice. Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad? Where is Nomad?
Vorga,
Foyle croaked.
Vorga.
He had been inoculated by his own fixation. His own nightmare had rendered him immune.
Where is Nomad? Where have you left Nomad? What happened to Nomad? Where is Nomad?
Vorga!
Foyle shouted.
Vorga! Vorga! Vorga!
In the control booth, Dagenham swore. The head of psychiatry, monitoring the projectors, glanced at the clock.
1:45, Saul. He can't stand much more.
He's got to break. Give him the final effect.
They buried Foyle alive, slowly, inexorably, hideously. He was carried down into black depths and enclosed in stinking slime that cut off light and air. He slowly suffocated, while a distant voice boomed,
Where is Nomad? Where have you left Nomad? You can escape if you find Nomad. Where is Nomad?
But Foyle was back aboard Nomad in his lightless, airless coffin, floating comfortably between deck and roof.
He curled into a tight fetal ball and prepared to sleep. He was content. He would escape. He would find Vorga.
Impervious bastard, Dagenham swore. Has anyone ever resisted Nightmare Theater before, Fritz?
Not many. You're right. That's an uncommon man, Saul.
He's got to be ripped open. All right. To hell with any more of this. We'll try the Miggle mood next. Are the actors ready?
All ready.
Then let's go. There are six directions in which delusions of grandeur can run. The Miggle, short for megalomania, mood, was therapy's dramatic diagnosis technique for establishing and plotting the particular course of megalomania. Foyle awoke in a luxurious four-poster bed. He was in a bedroom hung with brocade, papered in velvet. He glanced around curiously. Soft sunlight filtered through latticed windows. Across the room, a valet was quietly laying out clothes.
Hey, Foyle grunted.
The valet turned.
Good morning, Mr. Fourmile, he murmured.
What?
It's a lovely morning, sir. I've laid out the brown twill in the cordovan pump, sir.
What's the matter, you?
The valet gazed at Foyle curiously. Is anything wrong, Mr. Fourmile?
What do you call me, man?
By your name, sir.
My name is Fourmile?
Foyle struggled up in the bed.
No, it's not. It's Foyle. Gully Foyle, that's my name, me.
The valet bit his lip. One moment, sir. He stepped outside and called. Then he murmured. A lovely girl in white came running into the bedroom and sat down on the edge of the bed. She took Foyle's hands and gazed into his eyes. Her face was distressed.
Darling, 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 she whispered. You aren't going to start all that again, are you? The doctor swore you were over it.
Start what again?
All that Gulliver Foyle nonsense about your being a common sailor and...
I am Gully Foyle. That's my name, Gully Foyle.
Sweetheart, you are not. That's just a delusion you've had for weeks. You've been overworking and drinking too much.
Been Gully Foyle all my life, me.
Yes, I know, darling. That's the way it seemed to you. But you're not. You're Geoffrey Fourmile. The Geoffrey Fourmile. You're... What's the sense telling you? Get dressed, my love. You've got to come downstairs. Your office has been frantic.
Foyle permitted the valet to dress him and went downstairs in a daze. The lovely girl, who evidently adored him, conducted him through a giant studio littered with drawing tables, easels, and half-finished canvases. She took him into a vast hall filled with desks, filing cabinets, stock tickers, clerks, secretaries, office personnel. They entered a lofty laboratory cluttered with glass and chrome. Burners flickered and hissed. Bright-colored liquids bubbled and churned. There was a pleasant odor of interesting chemicals and odd experiments.
What's all this? Foyle asked.
The girl seated Foyle in a plush armchair alongside a giant desk littered with interesting papers scribbled with fascinating symbols. On some, Foyle saw the name Geoffrey Fourmile scrawled in an imposing, authoritative signature.
There's some crazy kind of mistake, is all, Foyle began.
The girl silenced him.
Here's Dr. Regan. He'll explain.
An impressive gentleman with a crisp, comforting manner came to Foyle, touched his pulse, inspected his eyes, and nodded in satisfaction.
Good, he said. Excellent. You are close to complete recovery, Mr. Fourmile. Now, you will listen to me for a moment, eh?
Foyle nodded.
You remember nothing of the past. You have only a false memory. You were overworked. You are an important man, and there were too many demands on you. You started to drink heavily a month ago. No, denial is useless. You drank. You lost yourself. You became convinced you were not the famous Jeff Fourmile. An infantile attempt to escape responsibility. You imagined you were a common spaceman named Foyle.
Gulliver Foyle, yes. With an odd number.
Gully Foyle. AS-128/127:006. But that's me.
It is not you. This is you. Dr. Regan waved at the interesting offices they could see through the transparent glass wall.
You can only recapture the true memory if you discharge the old. All this glorious reality is yours if we can help you discard the dream of the spaceman. Dr. Regan leaned forward, his polished spectacles glittering hypnotically. Reconstruct this false memory of yours in detail, and I will tear it down. Where do you imagine you left the spaceship Nomad? How did you escape? Where do you imagine the Nomad is now? Foyle wavered before the romantic glamour of the scene, which seemed to be just within his grasp.
It seems to me I left Nomad out in...
He stopped short. A devil face peered at him from the highlights reflected in Dr. Regan's spectacles. A hideous tiger mask with Nomad blazoned across the distorted brow. Foyle stood up.
Liars,
he growled.
It's real, me. This here is phony. What happened to me is real. I'm real, me.
Saul Dagenham walked into the laboratory. All right, he called. Strike. It's a washout. The bustling scene in laboratory, office, and studio ended. The actors quietly disappeared without another glance at Foyle. Dagenham gave Foyle his deadly smile. Tough, aren't you? You're really unique. My name is Saul Dagenham. We've got 5 minutes for a talk. Come into the garden. The sedative garden atop the therapy building was a triumph of therapeutic planning. Every perspective, every color, every contour had been designed to placate hostility, soothe resistance, melt anger, evaporate hysteria, absorb melancholia and depression. Sit down, Dagenham said, pointing to a bench alongside a pool in which crystal waters tinkled. Don't try to jaunt. You're drugged. I'll have to walk around a bit. Can't come too close to you. I am hot. Do you know what that means? Foyle shook his head sullenly. Dagenham cupped both hands around the flaming blossom of an orchid and held them there for a moment. Watch that flower, he said. You'll see. He paced up a path and turned suddenly. You're right, of course. Everything that happened to you is real. Only what did happen?
Go to hell,
Foyle growled. You know, Foyle, I admire you.
Go to hell.
In your own primitive way, you've got ingenuity and guts. You're Cro-Magnon, Foyle. I've been checking on you. That bomb you threw in the pristine shipyards was lovely, and you nearly wrecked General Hospital getting the money and material together. Dagenham counted fingers. You looted lockers, stole from the blind ward, stole drugs from the pharmacy, stole apparatus from the lab stockrooms.
Go to hell, you.
But what have you got against Pristine? Why do you try to blow up a shipyard? They tell me you broke in and went tearing through the pits like a wild man. What were you trying to do, Foyle?
Go to hell.
Dagenham smiled. If we're going to chat, he said, you'll have to hold up your end. Your conversation's getting monotonous. What happened to Nomad?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
The ship was last reported over 7 months ago. Are you the sole survivor? And what have you been doing all this time, having your face decorated?
I don't know about Nomad.
Nothing. No, Foyle, that won't do. You show up with Nomad tattooed across your face. Fresh tattooed. Intelligence checks and finds you were aboard Nomad when she sailed. Foyle, Gulliver. AS-128/127:006, mechanics mate, third class. As if all this isn't enough to throw intelligence into a tizzy, you come back in a private launch that's been missing 50 years. Man, you're cooking in the reactor. Intelligence wants the answers to all these questions. And you ought to know how central intelligence butchers its answers out of people. Foyle started. Dagenham nodded as he saw his point sink home. Which is why I think you'll listen to reason. We want information, Foyle. I tried to trick it out of you, admit it. I failed because you're too tough, admit it. Now I'm offering an honest deal. We'll protect you if you'll cooperate. If you don't, you'll spend 5 years in an intelligence lab having information chopped out of you. It was not the prospect of the butchery that frightened Foyle, but the thought of the loss of freedom.
A man had to be free to avenge himself, to raise money and find Vorga again, to rip and tear and gut Vorga.
What kind of deal?
He asked. Tell us what happened to Nomad and where you left her.
Why, man?
Why? Because of the salvage, man.
There ain't nothing to salvage. She's a wreck is all.
Even a wreck's salvageable.
You mean you jet out 1,000,000 miles to pick up pieces? Don't joke with me, man.
All right, Dagenham said in exasperation. There's the cargo.
She was split wide open. No cargo left.
It was a cargo you don't know about, Dagenham said confidentially. Nomad was transporting platinum bullion to Mars Bank. Every so often, banks have to adjust accounts. Normally, enough trade goes on between planets so that accounts can be balanced on paper. The wars disrupted normal trade, and Mars Bank found that Pristine owed them 20-odd million credits without any way of getting the money short of actual delivery. Pristine was delivering the money in bar platinum aboard the Nomad. It was locked in the purser's safe.
20 million?
Foyle whispered. Give or take a few thousand. The ship was insured, but that just means that the underwriters, Boness and Urg, get the salvage rights. And they're even tougher than Pristine. However, there'll be a reward for you. Say, 20,000 credits.
20 million?
Foyle whispered again. We're assuming that an OS raider caught up with Nomad somewhere on course and let her have it. They couldn't have boarded and looted, or you wouldn't have been left alive. This means that the purser's safe is still... Are you listening, Foyle? But Foyle was not listening. He was seeing 20 million, not 20,000. 20 million in platinum bullion as a broad highway to Vorga. No more petty thefts from lockers and labs. 20 million for the taking and the raising of Vorga. Foyle! Foyle awoke. He looked at Dagenham.
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing, he said.
What the hell's got into you now? Why are you dummying up again?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
I'm offering a fair reward. A spaceman can go on a hell of a tear with 20,000 credits. A 1-year tear. What more do you want?
I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
It's us or intelligence, Foyle.
You ain't so anxious for them to get me, or you wouldn't be flipping through all this. But it ain't no use anyway. I don't know about Nomad. Nothing.
You son of a... Dagenham tried to repress his anger. He had revealed just a little too much to this cunning, primitive creature. You're right, he said. We're not anxious for intelligence to get you. But we've made our own preparations. His voice hardened. You think you can dummy up and stand us off? You think you can leave us to whistle for Nomad? You've even got an idea that you can beat us to the salvage.
No,
Foyle said. Now listen to this. We've got a lawyer waiting in New York. He's got a criminal prosecution for piracy pending against you. Piracy in space, murder, and looting. We're going to throw the book at you. Pristine will get a conviction in 24 hours. If you've got a criminal record of any kind, that means a lobotomy. They'll open up the top of your skull and burn out half your brain to stop you from ever jaunting again. Dagenham stopped and looked hard at Foyle. When Foyle shook his head, Dagenham continued, If you haven't a record, they'll hand you 10 years of what is laughingly known as medical treatment. We don't punish criminals in our enlightened age. We cure them. And the cure is worse than punishment. They'll stash you in a black hole in one of the cave hospitals. You'll be kept in permanent darkness and solitary confinement, so you can't jaunt out. They'll go through the motions of giving you shots and therapy, but you'll be rotting in the dark. You'll stay there and rot until you decide to talk. We'll keep you there forever, so make up your mind.
I don't know nothing about Nomad. Nothing,
Foyle said. All right, Dagenham spat. Suddenly he pointed to the orchid blossom he had enclosed with his hands. It was blighted and rotting.
That's what's going to happen to you.
Chapter 5. South of Saint-Girons, near the Spanish-French border, is the deepest abyss in France, the Jouffre Martel. Its caverns twist for miles under the Pyrenees.
It is the most formidable cavern hospital on Terra. No patient has ever jaunted out of its pitch darkness. No patient has ever succeeded in getting his bearings and learning the jaunt coordinates of the black hospital depths. Short of prefrontal lobotomy, there are only three ways to stop a man from jaunting. A blow on the head producing concussion, sedation which prevents concentration, and concealment of jaunt coordinates. Of the three, the jaunting aids considered concealment the most practical. The cells that line the winding passages of Jouffre Martel are cut out of living rock. They are never illuminated. The passages are never illuminated. Infrared lamps flood the darkness. It is black light, visible only to guards and attendants wearing snooper goggles with specially treated lenses. For the patients, there is only the black silence of Jouffre Martel, broken by the distant rush of underground waters. For Foyle, there was only the silence, the rushing, and the hospital routine. At 8 o'clock, or it may have been any hour in this timeless abyss, he was awakened by a bell. He arose and received his morning meal, slotted into the cell by pneumatic tube. It had to be eaten at once, for the china surrogate of cups and plates was timed to dissolve in 15 minutes. At 8:30, the cell door opened, and Foyle and hundreds of others shuffled blindly through the twisting corridors to sanitation. Here, still in darkness, they were processed like beef in a slaughterhouse, cleansed, shaved, irradiated, disinfected, dosed, and inoculated. Their paper uniforms were removed and sent back to the shops to be pulped. New uniforms were issued. Then they shuffled back to their cells, which had been automatically scrubbed out while they were in sanitation. In his cell, Foyle listened to interminable therapeutic talks, lectures, moral and ethical guidance for the rest of the morning. Then there was silence again, and nothing but the rush of distant water and the quiet steps of goggled guards in the corridors. In the afternoon came occupational therapy. The TV screen in each cell illuminated, and the patient thrust his hands into the shadow frame of the screen. He saw three-dimensionally, and he felt the broadcast objects and tools. He cut hospital uniforms, sewed them, manufactured kitchen utensils, and prepared foods. Although actually he touched nothing, his motions were transmitted to the shops where the work was accomplished by remote control. After one short hour of this relief, came the darkness and silence again. But every so often, once or twice a week, or perhaps once or twice a year, came the muffled thud of a distant explosion. The concussions were startling enough to distract Foyle from the furnace of vengeance that he stoked all through the silences. He whispered questions to the invisible figures around him in sanitation.
"What's them explosions?"
"Explosions?
Blow-ups. Hear him a long way off me.
Them's blue jaunts."
"What?"
"Blue jaunts. Every sometime a guy gets fed up with old Jeffrey. Can't take it no more, him. Jaunts into the wild blue yonder."
"Jesus."
"Yep. Don't know where they are, them. Don't know where they're going. Blue jaunt into the dark. And we hear him exploding in the mountains. Boom! Blue jaunt."
He was appalled, but he could understand. The darkness, the silence, the monotony destroyed sense and brought on desperation. The loneliness was intolerable. The patients buried in Jouffre Martel Prison Hospital looked forward eagerly to the morning sanitation period for a chance to whisper a word and hear a word. But these fragments were not enough, and desperation came. Then there would be another distant explosion. Sometimes the suffering men would turn on each other, and then a savage fight would break out in sanitation. These were instantly broken up by the goggled guards, and the morning lecture would switch on the moral fiber record, preaching the virtue of patience. Foyle learned the records by heart, every word, every click and crack in the tapes. He learned to loathe the voices of the lecturers, the understanding baritone, the cheerful tenor, the man-to-man bass. He learned to deafen himself to the therapeutic monotony and perform his occupational therapy mechanically, but he was without resources to withstand the endless solitary hours. Fury was not enough. He lost count of the days, of meals, of sermons. He no longer whispered in sanitation.
His mind came adrift, and he began to wander. He imagined he was back aboard Nomad, reliving his fight for survival. Then he lost even this feeble grasp on illusion and began to sink deeper and deeper into the pit of catatonia, of womb silence, womb darkness, and womb sleep. There were fleeting dreams. An angel hummed to him once. Another time she sang quietly. Thrice he heard her speak.
Oh, God.
And
God damn.
And
oh.
In a heart-rending, descending note. He sank into his abyss, listening to her.
There is a way out,
his angel murmured in his ear, sweetly comforting. Her voice was soft and warm, yet it burned with anger. It was the voice of a furious angel.
There is a way out,
it whispered in his ear from nowhere. And suddenly, with the logic of desperation, it came to him that there was a way out of Jouffre Martel. He had been a fool not to see it before.
Yes, he croaked. There's a way out.
There was a soft gasp, then a soft question. Who's there?
Me is all, Boyle said. You know me.
Where are you?
Here. Where I always been, me.
But there's no one. I'm alone.
Got to thank you for helping me.
Hearing voices is bad,
the furious angel murmured. The first step off the deep end. I've got to stop.
You showed me the way out. Blue jaunt.
Blue jaunt? My God, this must be real. You're talking the Gatolingo. You must be real. Who are you?
Gully Foyle.
But you're not in my cell. You're not even near. Men are in the north quadrant of Jouffre Martel. Women are in the south. I'm south 900. Where are you?
North 111.
You're a quarter of a mile away. How can we... Of course. It's the Whisper Line. I always thought that was a legend, but it's true. It's working now.
Here I go, me, Foyle whispered. Blue jaunt.
Foyle, listen to me. Forget the blue jaunt. Don't throw this away. It's a miracle.
What's a miracle?
There's an acoustical freak in Jouffre Martel. They happen in underground caves. A freak of echoes, passages, and whispering galleries. Old-timers call it the Whisper Line. I never believed them. No one ever did. But it's true. We're talking to each other over the Whisper Line. No one can hear us but us. We can talk, Foyle. We can plan. Maybe we can escape.
Her name was Gisbella McQueen. She was hot-tempered, independent, intelligent, and she was serving 5 years of cure in Jouffre Martel for larceny. Gisbella gave Foyle a cheerfully furious account of her revolt against society.
You don't know what jaunting's done to women, Gully. It's locked us up, sent us back to the Seraglio.
What's Seraglio, girl?
A harem, a place where women are kept on ice. After 1,000 years of civilization, it says here, we're still property. Jaunting's such a danger to our virtue, our value, our mint condition, that we're locked up like gold plate in a safe. There's nothing for us to do, nothing respectable. No jobs, no careers. There's no getting out, Gully, unless you bust out and smash all the rules.
Did you have to, Jizz?
I had to be independent, Gully. I had to live my own life. And that's the only way society would let me. So I ran away from home and turned crook.
And Jizz went on to describe the lurid details of her revolt. The temper racket, the cataract racket, the honeymoon and obituary robs, the badger jaunt and the glim drop. Foyle told her about Nomad and Vorga, his hatred and his plans. He did not tell Gisbella about his face or the 20 millions in platinum bullion waiting out in the asteroids.
What happened to Nomad? Gisbella asked. Was it like that man Dagenham said? Was she blasted by an OS raider?
I don't know, me. Can't remember, girl.
The blast probably wiped out your memory. Shock. And being marooned for 6 months didn't help. Did you notice anything worth salvaging from Nomad?
No.
Did Dagenham mention anything?
No,
Foyle lied.
Then he must have another reason for hounding you into Jouffre Martel. There must be something else he wants from Nomad.
Yeah, it is.
But you were a fool trying to blow up Vorga like that. You're like a wild beast trying to punish the trap that injured it. Steel isn't alive. It doesn't think. You can't punish Vorga.
Don't know what you mean, girl. Vorga passed me by.
You punish the brain, Gully. The brain that sets the trap. Find out who was aboard Vorga. Find out who gave the order to pass you by. Punish him.
Yeah. How?
Learn to think, Gully. The head that could figure out how to get Nomad underway and how to put a bomb together ought to be able to figure that out. But no more bombs. Brains instead. Locate a member of Vorga's crew. He'll tell you who was aboard. Track them down. Find out who gave the order. Then punish him. But it'll take time, Gully. Time and money. More than you've got.
I got a whole life, me.
They murmured for hours across the whisper line, their voices sounding small yet close to the ear. There was only one particular spot in each cell where the other could be heard, which was why so much time had passed before they discovered the miracle. But now they made up for lost time, and Gisbella educated Foyle.
If we ever break out of Jouffre Martel, Gully, it'll have to be together, and I'm not trusting myself to an illiterate partner.
Who's illiterate?
You are, Gisbella answered firmly. I have to talk gutter you half the time, me.
I can read and write.
And that's about all, which means that outside of brute strength you'll be useless.
Talk sense, you,
he said angrily.
I am talking sense, me. What's the use of the strongest chisel in the world if it doesn't have an edge? We've got to sharpen your wits, Gully. Got to educate you, man, is all.
He submitted. He realized she was right. He would need training, not only for the bust-out, but for the search for Vorga as well. Gisbella was the daughter of an architect and had received an education. This she drilled into Foyle, leavened with the cynical experience of 5 years in the underworld. Occasionally he rebelled against the hard work, and then there would be whispered quarrels, but in the end he would apologize and submit again. And sometimes Gisbella would tire of teaching, and then they would ramble on, sharing dreams in the dark.
I think we're falling in love, Gully.
I think so too, Gis.
I'm an old hag, Gully. 105 years old. What are you like?
Awful.
How awful?
My face.
You make yourself sound romantic. Is it one of those exciting scars that make a man attractive?
No. You'll see when we meet us. That's wrong, isn't it? Just plain, when we meet, period.
Good boy.
We will meet someday, won't we, Jiz?
Soon, I hope, Gully.
Gisbella's faraway voice became crisp and businesslike.
But we've got to stop hoping and get down to work. We've got to plan and prepare.
From the underworld, Gisbella had inherited a mass of information about Jouffre Martel. No one had ever jaunted out of the cavern hospitals, but for decades the underworld had been collecting and collating information about them. It was from this data that Gisbella had formed her quick recognition of the whisper line that joined them. It was on the basis of this information that she began to discuss escape.
We can pull it off, Gully. Never doubt that for a minute. There must be dozens of loopholes in their security system.
No one's ever found them before.
No one's ever worked with a partner before. We'll pool our information and we'll make it.
He no longer shambled to sanitation and back. He felt the corridor walls, noted doors, noted their texture, counted, listened, deduced, and reported. He made a note of every separate step in the sanitation pens and reported them to Jiz. The questions he whispered to the men around him in the shower and scrub rooms had purpose. Together, Foyle and Gisbella built up a picture of the routine of Jouffre Martel and its security system. One morning, on the return from sanitation, he was stopped as he was about to step back into a cell.
Stay in line, Foyle.
This is North 111. I know where to get off by now.
Keep moving.
But...
He was terrified.
You're changing me?
Visitor to see you.
He was marched up to the end of the north corridor, where it met the three other main corridors that formed the huge cross of the hospital. In the center of the cross were the administration offices, maintenance workshops, clinics, and plants. Foyle was thrust into a room as dark as his cell. The door was shut behind him. He became aware of a faint shimmering outline in the blackness. It was no more than the ghost of an image with a blurred body and a death's head. Two black disks on the skull face were either eye sockets or infrared goggles.
"Good morning," said Saul Bigenham.
"You?"
Ford exclaimed.
"Me. I've got 5 minutes. Sit down. Chair behind you."
Foyle felt for the chair and sat down slowly.
"Enjoying yourself?"
Bigenham inquired.
"What do you want, Bigenham?"
"There's been a change," Bigenham said dryly. "Last time we talked, your dialogue consisted entirely of go to hell."
"Go to hell, Bigenham, if it'll make you feel any better."
"Your repartee's improved. Your speech, too. You've changed,"
Bigenham said.
"Changed a damned sight too much and a damned sight too fast. I don't like it. What's happened to you?"
"I've been going to night school."
"You've had 10 months in this night school."
10 months?
Foyle echoed in amazement.
"That long?"
10 months without sight and without sound. 10 months in solitary. You ought to be broke."
"Oh, I'm broke, all right."
"You ought to be whining." "I was right. You're unusual. At this rate, it's going to take too long. We can't wait. I'd like to make a new offer."
"Make it."
10% of Nomad's bullion. $2 million.
$2 million?
Foyle exclaimed.
"Why didn't you offer that in the first place?"
"Because I didn't know your caliber." "Is it a deal?"
"Almost. Not yet."
"What else?"
"I get out of Jouffre Martel."
"Naturally."
"And someone else, too."
"It can be arranged."
Bigenham's voice sharpened. "Anything else?"
"I get access to Pristine's files."
"Out of the question. Are you insane? Be reasonable."
"His shipping files."
"What for?"
"A list of personnel aboard one of his ships."
"Oh." Bigenham's eagerness revived. "That I can arrange. Anything else?"
"No."
"Then it's a deal."
Bigenham was delighted. The ghostly blur of light arose from its chair.
"We'll have you out in 6 hours. We'll start arrangements for your friend at once. It's a pity we wasted this time, but no one can figure you, Foyle."
"Why didn't you send in a telepath to work me over?"
"A telepath? Be reasonable, Foyle. There aren't 10 full telepaths in all the inner planets. Their time is earmarked for the next 10 years. We couldn't persuade one to interrupt his schedule for love or money."
"I apologize, Dagenham. I thought you didn't know your business. You very nearly hurt my feelings. Now I know you're just lying."
"You're flattering me."
"You could have hired a telepath. For a cut in $20 million, you could have hired one easy."
"The government would never..."
"They don't all work for the government. No, you've got something too hot to let a telepath get near."
The blur of light leaped across the room and seized Foyle.
"How much do you know, Foyle? What are you covering? Who are you working for?"
Dagenham's hands shook.
"Christ, what a fool I've been. Of course you're unusual. You're no common spaceman. I asked you, who are you working for?"
Foyle tore Dagenham's hands away from him.
"No one," he said. "No one, except myself."
"No one, eh? Including your friend in Jouffre Martel you're so eager to rescue? By God, you almost swindled me, Foyle. Tell Captain Yang Yeovil I congratulate him. He's got a better staff than I thought."
"I never heard of any Yang Yeovil."
"You and your colleague are going to rot here. It's no deal. You'll fester here. I'll have you moved to the worst cell in the hospital. I'll sink you to the bottom of Jouffre Martel. I'll..." "God, here!
Foyle grasped Dagenham's throat, dragged him down to the floor, and hammered his head on the flagstones. Dagenham squirmed once and then was still. Foyle ripped the goggles off his face and put them on. Sight returned in soft red and rose lights and shadows. He was in a small reception room with a table and 2 chairs. Foyle stripped Dagenham's jacket off and put it on with 2 quick jerks that split the shoulders. Dagenham's cocked highwayman's hat lay on the table. Foyle clapped it over his head and pulled the brim down before his face. On opposite walls were two doors. Foyle opened one a crack. It led out to the north corridor. He closed it, leaped across the room, and tried the other. It opened onto a jaunt-proof maze. Foyle slipped through the door and entered the maze. Without a guide to lead him through the labyrinth, he was immediately lost. He began to run around the twists and turns and found himself back at the reception room. Dagenham was struggling to his knees. Foyle turned back into the maze again. He ran. He came to a closed door and thrust it open. It revealed a large workshop illuminated by normal light. Two technicians working at a machine bench looked up in surprise. Foyle snatched up a sledgehammer, leaped on them like a caveman, and felled them. Behind him, he heard Dagenham shouting in the distance. He looked around wildly, dreading the discovery that he was trapped in a cul-de-sac. The workshop was L-shaped. Foyle tore around the corner, burst through the entrance of another jaunt-proof maze, and was lost again. The Jouffre Martel alarm system began clattering. Foyle battered at the walls of the labyrinth with a sledge, shattered the thin plastic masking, and found himself in the infrared-lit south corridor of the women's quadrant. Two women guards came up the corridor, running hard. Foyle swung the sledge and dropped them. He was near the head of the corridor. Before him stretched a long perspective of cell doors, each bearing a glowing red number. Overhead, the corridor was lit by glowing red globes. Foyle stood on tiptoe and clubbed the globe above him. He hammered through the socket and smashed the current cable. The entire corridor went dark, even to goggles.
"Evens us up. All in the dark now," Foyle gasped, and tore down the corridor, feeling the wall as he ran and counting cell doors.
Gisbella had given him an accurate word picture of the south quadrant. He was counting his way toward South 900. He blundered into a figure, another guard. Foyle hacked at her once with his sledge. She shrieked and fell. The women patients began shrieking. Foyle lost count, ran on, stopped.
"Jizz!"
he bellowed. He heard her voice. He encountered another guard, disposed of her, ran, located Gisbella's cell.
"Gully, for God's sake!"
Her voice was muffled.
"Get back, girl, back!"
He hammered thrice against the door with his sledge, and it burst inward. He staggered in and fell against a figure.
"Jizz,"
he gasped.
"Excuse me. Was passing by. Thought I'd drop in."
"Golly, in the name of..."
"Yeah, hell of a way to meet, huh? Come on. Out, girl, out!"
He dragged her out of the cell.
"We can't try a break through the offices. They don't like me back there. Which way to your sanitation pens?"
"Golly, you're crazy."
"Oh, quadrant's dark. I smashed the power cable. We've got half a chance. Go, girl, go!"
He gave her a powerful thrust, and she led him down the passages to the automatic stalls of the women's sanitation pens. While mechanical hands removed their uniforms, soaped, soaked, sprayed, and disinfected them, Foyle felt for the glass pane of the medical observation window. He found it, swung the sledge, and smashed it.
"Get in, Jizz."
He hurled her through the window and followed. They were both stripped, greasy with soap, slashed and bleeding. Foyle slipped and crashed through the blackness, searching for the door through which the medical officers entered.
"Can't find a door, Jizz. Door from the clinic.
Shh! But be quiet, Gully." A soapy hand found his mouth and clamped over it. She gripped his shoulder so hard that her fingernails pierced his skin. Through the bedlam in the caverns sounded the clatter of steps close at hand. Guards were running blindly through the sanitation stalls. The infrared lights had not yet been repaired.
"They may not notice the window,"
Gisbella hissed.
"Be quiet."
They crouched on the floor. Steps trampled through the pens in bewildering succession. Then they were gone.
"All clear now,"
Gisbella whispered.
"But they'll have searchlights any minute. Come on, Gully, out."
"But the door to the clinic, Jizz, I thought..."
"There is no door. They use spiral stairs and they pull them up. They've thought of this escape, too. We'll have to try the laundry lift. God knows what good it'll do us. Oh, Gully, you fool! You utter fool!"
They climbed through the observation window back into the pens. They searched through the darkness for the lifts by which soiled uniforms were removed and fresh uniforms issued. And in the darkness, the automatic hands again soaped, sprayed, and disinfected them. They could find nothing. The caterwauling of a siren suddenly echoed through the caverns, silencing all other sound. There came a hush, as suffocating as the darkness.
"They're using the G-phone to track us, Gully."
"What?"
"Geophone. It can trace a whisper through half a mile of solid rock. That's why they've sirened for silence."
"The laundry lift?"
"Can't find it."
"Then come on."
"Where?"
"We're running."
Where?
I don't know, but I'm not getting caught flat-footed. Come on. The exercise will do you good.
Again he thrust Gisbella before him, and they ran, gasping and stumbling, through the blackness, down into the deepest reaches of South Quadrant. Gisbella fell twice, blundering against turns in the passages. Foyle took the lead and ran, holding the 20-pound sledge in his hand, the handle extended before him as an antenna. Then they crashed into a blank wall and realized they had reached the dead end of the corridor. They were boxed, trapped.
What now?
Don't know. Looks like the dead end of my ideas, too. We can't go back for sure. I clobbered Dagenham in the offices. Hate that man. Looks like a poison label. You got a flash, girl?
Oh, golly. Golly,
Gisbella sobbed.
Was counting on you for ideas. No more bombs, you said. Wish I had one now. Could... Wait a minute.
He touched the oozing wall against which they were leaning. He felt the checkerboard indentations of mortar seams.
Bulletin from G. Foyle. This isn't a natural cave wall. It's made. Brick and stone. Feel.
Gisbella felt the wall.
So?
Means this passage don't end here. Goes on. They blocked it off. Out of the way.
He shoved Gisbella up the passage, ground his hands into the floor to grit his soapy palms, and began swinging the sledge against the wall. He swung in steady rhythm, grunting and gasping. The steel sledge struck the wall with a blunt concussion of stones struck underwater.
They're coming, Jis said. I hear them.
The blunt blows took on a crumbling, crushing overtone. There was a whisper, then a steady pebble fall of loose mortar. Foyle redoubled his efforts. Suddenly there was a crash, and a gush of icy air blew in their faces.
Through,
Foyle muttered. He attacked the edges of the hole, pierced through the wall with ferocity. Bricks, stones, and old mortar flew. Foyle stopped and called Gisbella.
Try it.
He dropped the sledge, seized her, and held her up to the chest-high opening. She cried out in pain as she tried to wriggle past the sharp edges. Foyle pressed her relentlessly until she got her shoulders and then her hips through. He let go of her legs and heard her fall on the other side. Foyle pulled himself up and tore himself through the jagged breach in the wall. He felt Gisbella's hands trying to break his fall as he crashed down on a mass of loose brick and mortar. They were both through into the icy blackness of the unoccupied caverns of Jouffre Martel, miles of unexplored grottos and caves.
By God, we'll make it yet,
Foyle mumbled.
I don't know if there's a way out, Gully.
Gisbella was shaking with cold.
Maybe this is all cul-de-sac, walled off from the hospital.
There has to be a way out.
I don't know if we can find it.
We've got to find it. Let's go, girl.
They blundered forward in the darkness. Foyle tore the useless set of goggles from his eyes. They crashed against ledges, corners, low ceilings. They fell down slopes and steep steps. They climbed over a razorback ridge to a level plain, and their feet shot from under them. Both fell heavily to a glassy floor. Foyle felt it and touched it with his tongue.
Ice,
he muttered.
Good sign. We're in an ice cavern, Jiz. Underground glacier.
They arose shakily, straddling their legs, and worked their way across the ice that had been forming in the Jouffre Martel abyss for millennia. They climbed into a forest of stone saplings that were stalagmites and stalactites thrusting up from the jagged floor and down from the ceilings. The vibrations of every step loosened the huge stalactites. Ponderous stone spears thundered down from overhead. At the edge of the forest, Foyle stopped, reached out, and tugged. There was a clear, metallic ring. He took Gisbella's hand and placed the long, tapering cone of a stalagmite in it.
Cain, he grunted. Use it like a blind man.
He broke off another, and they went tapping, feeling, stumbling through the darkness. There was no sound but the gallop of panic, their gasping breath and racing hearts, the taps of their stone canes, the multitudinous drip of water, the distant rushing of the underground river beneath Jouffre Martel.
Not that way, girl.
Foyle nudged her shoulder. More to the left.
Have you the faintest notion where we're headed, Gully?
Down, Jiz. Follow any slope that leads down.
You've got an idea?
Yeah, surprise, surprise. Brains instead of bombs?
Brains instead of...
Gisbella shrieked with hysterical laughter.
You exploded into South Quadrant with the sledgehammer, and that's your idea of brains instead of...
She brayed and hooted beyond all control,
until Foyle grasped her and shook her.
Shut up, Chiz. If they're tracking us by G-phone, they could hear you from Mars.
Sorry, Gully. Sorry,
She took a breath.
Why down?
The river, the one we hear all the time. It must be near. It probably melts off the glacier back there.
The river?
The only sure way out. It must break out of the mountain somewhere. We'll swim.
Gully, you're insane.
What's the matter, you? You can't swim?
I can swim, but...
Then we've got to try. Got to, Jiz. Come on.
The rush of the river grew louder as their strength began to fail. Gisbella pulled to a halt at last, gasping.
Gully, I've got to rest.
Too cold. Keep moving.
I can't.
Keep moving.
He felt for her arm.
Get your hands off me,
she cried furiously. In an instant, she was all spitfire. He released her in amazement.
What's the matter with you? Keep your head, Jiz. I'm depending on you.
For what? I told you we had to plan, work out an escape, and now you've trapped us into this.
I was trapped myself. Dagenham was going to change my cell. No more whisper line for us. I had to, Jiz. And we're out, aren't we?
Out where? Lost in Jouffre Martel? Looking for a damned river to drown in? You're a fool, Gully, and I'm an idiot for letting you trap me into this. Damn you. Damn you. You pull everything down to your imbecile level, and you've pulled me down, too. Run, fight, punch. That's all you know. Beat, break, blast, destroy. Gully!
Gisbella screamed. There was a clatter of loose stone in the darkness, and her scream faded down and away to a heavy splash. Foyle heard the thrash of her body in water. He leaped forward, shouted, Jiz! And staggered over the edge of a precipice. He fell and struck the water flat with a stunning impact. The icy river enclosed him, and he could not tell where the surface was. He struggled, suffocated, felt the swift current drag him against the chill slime of rocks, and then was borne bubbling to the surface. He coughed and shouted. He heard Gisbella answer, her voice faint and muffled by the roaring torrent. He swam with the current, trying to overtake her. He shouted and heard her answering voice growing fainter and fainter. The roaring grew louder, and abruptly he was shot down the hissing sheet of a waterfall. He plunged to the bottom of a deep pool and struggled once more to the surface. The whirling current entangled him with a cold body bracing itself against a smooth rock wall.
Jiz!
Gully, thank God!
They clung together for a moment while the water tore at them.
Gully,
Gisbella coughed.
It goes through here.
The river?
Yes.
He squirmed past her, bracing himself against the wall, and felt the mouth of an underwater tunnel. The current was sucking them into it.
Hold on,
Foyle gasped. He explored to the left and the right. The walls of the pool were smooth, without handhold.
We can't climb out. Have to go through.
There's no air, Gully, no surface.
Couldn't be forever. We'll hold our breath.
It could be longer than we can hold our breath.
Have to gamble.
I can't do it.
You must. No other way. Pump your lungs. Hold on to me.
They supported each other in the water, gasping for breath, filling their lungs. Foyle nudged Gisbella toward the underwater tunnel.
You go first. I'll be right behind. Help you if you get into trouble.
Trouble?
Gisbella cried in a shaking voice. She submerged and permitted the current to suck her into the tunnel mouth. Foyle followed. The fierce waters drew them down, 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 caroming from side to side of a tunnel that had been worn glass smooth. Foyle swam close behind Gisbella, feeling her thrashing legs beat his head and shoulders. They shot through the tunnel until their lungs burst and their blind eyes started. Then there was a roaring again and a surface, and they could breathe. The glassy tunnel sides were replaced by jagged rocks. Foyle caught Gisbella's leg and seized a stone projection at the side of the river.
Gotta climb out here,
he shouted.
What?
Got to climb out. You hear that roaring up ahead. Cataracts, rapids, be torn to pieces. Out, Jiz.
She was too weak to climb out of the water. He thrust her body up onto the rocks and followed. They lay on the dripping stones, too exhausted to speak. At last, Foyle got wearily to his feet.
Have to keep on,
he said.
Follow the river. Ready?
She could not answer. She could not protest. He pulled her up and they went stumbling through the darkness, trying to follow the bank of the torrent. The boulders they traversed were gigantic, standing like dolmens, heaped
jumbled, scattered into a labyrinth. They staggered and twisted through them and lost the river. They could hear it in the darkness. They could not get back to it. They could get nowhere.
Lost,
Foyle grunted in disgust.
We're lost again. Really lost this time. What are we going to do?
Gisbella began to cry. She made helpless yet furious sounds. Foyle lurched to a stop and sat down, drawing her down with him.
Maybe you're right, girl,
he said wearily.
Maybe I am a damned fool. I got us trapped into this no-jaunt jam, and we're licked.
She didn't answer.
So much for brain work. Hell of an education you gave me.
He hesitated.
You think we ought to try backtracking to the hospital?
We'll never make it.
Guess not. We're just practicing my brain. Should we start a racket? Make a noise so they can track us by G-phone?
They'd never hear us. Never find us in time.
We could make enough noise. You could knock me around a little. Be a pleasure for both of us.
Shut up.
What a mess.
He sagged back, cushioning his head on a tuft of soft grass.
At least I had a chance aboard Nomad. There was food, and I could see where I was trying to go. I could...
He broke off and sat bolt upright.
Jizz!
Don't talk so much.
He felt the ground under him and clawed up sods of earth and tufts of grass. He thrust them into her face.
Smell this,
he laughed.
Taste it. It's grass, jizz. Earth and grass. We must be out of Jules Fromartel.
What?
It's night outside, pitch black, overcast. We came out of the caves and never knew it. We're out, jizz. We made it.
They leaped to their feet, peering, listening, sniffing. The night was impenetrable, but they heard the soft sigh of night winds and the sweet scent of green growing things came to their nostrils. Far in the distance, a dog barked.
My God, Gully,
Gisbella whispered incredulously.
You're right. We're out of Jules Fromartel. All we have to do is wait for dawn.
She laughed. She flung her arms about him and kissed him, and he returned to the embrace. They babbled excitedly. They sank down on the soft grass again, weary but unable to rest, eager, impatient, all life before them.
Hello, Gully, darling Gully. Hello, Gully, after all this time.
Hello, Jizz.
I told you we'd meet someday. Someday soon. I told you, darling. And this is the day.
The night.
The night, so it is. But no more murmuring in the night along the whisper line. No more night for us, Gully dear.
Suddenly, they became aware that they were nude, lying close, no longer separated. Gisbella fell silent, but did not move. He clasped her, almost angrily, and enveloped her with a desire that was no less than hers. When dawn came, he saw that she was lovely, long and lean, with smoky red hair and a generous mouth. But when dawn came, she saw his face. Chapter 6 Harley Baker, M.D., had a small general practice in Montana, Oregon, which was legitimate and barely paid for the diesel oil he consumed each weekend participating in the rallies for vintage tractors, which were the vogue in Sahara. His real income was earned in his freak factory in Trenton, to which Baker jaunted every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. There, for enormous fees and no questions asked, Baker created monstrosities for the entertainment business and refashioned skin, muscle, and bone for the underworld. Looking like a male midwife, Baker sat on the cool veranda of his Spokane mansion, listening to Jizz McQueen finish the story of her escape.
Once we hit the open country outside Jules Fromartel, it was easy. We found a shooting lodge, broke in, and got some clothes. There were guns there, too, lovely old steel things for killing with explosives. We took them and sold them to some locals. Then we bought rides to the nearest jaunt stage we had memorized.
Which?
Biarritz.
Traveled by night, huh?
Naturally.
Do anything about Foyle's face?
We tried makeup, but that didn't work. The damned tattooing showed through. Then I bought a dark skin surrogate and sprayed it on.
Did that do it?
No, Jizz said angrily. You have to keep your face quiet or else the surrogate cracks and peels. Foyle couldn't control himself. He never can. It was hell.
Where is he now?
Sam Quatz got him in tow.
I thought Sam retired from the rackets.
He did, Gisbella said grimly, but he owes me a favor. He's minding Foyle. They're circulating on the jaunt to stay ahead of the cops.
Interesting, Baker murmured. Haven't seen a tattoo case in all my life. Thought it was a dead art. I'd like to add him to my collection. You know I collect curios, Jez?
Everybody knows that zoo of yours in Trenton, Baker. It's ghastly.
I picked up a genuine fraternal cyst last month, Baker began enthusiastically.
I don't want to hear about it, Jez snapped. And I don't want Foyle in your zoo. Can you get the muck off his face? Clean it up? He says they were stymied at General Hospital.
They haven't had my experience, dear. I seem to remember reading something once. Somewhere. Now, where did I...
Wait a minute. Baker stood up and disappeared with a faint pop. Gisbella paced the veranda furiously until he reappeared 20 minutes later with a tattered book in his hands and a triumphant expression on his face.
Got it, Baker said. Saw it in the Caltech stacks 3 years ago. You may admire my memory.
To hell with your memory. What about his face?
It can be done. Baker flipped the fragile pages and meditated. Yes, it can be done. Indigotin disulfonic acid. I may have to synthesize the acid, but...
Baker closed the text and nodded emphatically.
I can do it. Only it seems a pity to tamper with that face, if it's as unique as you describe.
Will you get off your hobby? Gisbella exclaimed in exasperation. We're hot, understand? The first that ever broke out of Jouffre Martel. The cops won't rest until they've got us back. This is extra special for them.
But
how long do you think we can stay out of Jouffre Martel with Foyle running around with that tattooed face?
What are you so angry about?
I'm not angry. I'm explaining.
He'd be happy in the zoo, Baker said persuasively. And he'd be undercover there. I'd put him in the room next to the Cyclops girl.
The zoo is out. That's definite.
All right, dear. But why are you worried about Foyle being recaptured? It won't have anything to do with you.
Why should you worry about me worrying? I'm asking you to do a job. I'm paying for the job.
It'll be expensive, dear, and I'm fond of you. I'm trying to save you money.
No, you're not.
But I'm curious.
Then let's say I'm grateful. He helped me. Now I'm helping him.
Baker smiled cynically. Then let's help him by giving him a brand new face.
No.
I thought so. You want his face cleaned up because you're interested in his face.
Damn you, Baker. Will you do the job or not?
It'll cost $5,000.
Break that down.
$1,000 to synthesize the acid, $3,000 for the surgery, and $1,000 for...
Your curiosity?
No, dear. Baker smiled again. $1,000 for the anesthetist.
Why anesthesia?
Baker reopened the ancient text. It looks like a painful operation. You know how they tattoo? They take a needle, dip it in dye, and hammer it into the skin. To bleach that dye out, I'll have to go over his face with a needle, pore by pore, and hammer in the indigotin disulfonic. It'll hurt. Gisbella's eyes flashed.
Can you do it without the dope?
I can, dear, but Foyle...
To hell with Foyle. I'm paying $4,000. No dope, Baker. Let Foyle suffer.
Jiz, you don't know what you're letting him in for.
I know. Let him suffer.
She laughed so furiously that she startled Baker.
Let his face make him suffer, too.
Baker's Freak Factory occupied a round, brick, three-story building that had once been the roundhouse in a suburban railway yard before jaunting ended the need for suburban railroads. The ancient ivy-covered roundhouse was alongside the Trenton rocket pits, and the rear windows looked out on the mouths of the pits thrusting their anti-grav beams upward, and Baker's patients could amuse themselves watching the spaceships riding silently up and down the beams, their portholes blazing,
recognition signals blinking, their hulls rippling with St. Elmo's fire as the atmosphere carried off the electrostatic charges built up in outer space. The basement floor of the factory contained Baker's zoo of anatomical curiosities, natural freaks and monsters bought and or abducted. Baker, like the rest of his world, was passionately devoted to these creatures and spent long hours with them, drinking in the spectacle of their distortions the way other men saturated themselves with the beauty of art. The middle floor of the roundhouse contained bedrooms for post-operative patients, laboratories, staff rooms, and kitchens. The top floor contained the operating theaters. In one of the latter, a small room usually used for retinal experiments, Baker was at work on Foyle's face. Under a harsh battery of lamps, he bent over the operating table, working meticulously with a small steel hammer and a platinum needle. Baker was following the pattern of the old tattooing on Foyle's face, searching out each minute scar in the skin and driving the needle into it. Foyle's head was gripped in a clamp, but his body was unstrapped. His muscles writhed at each tap of the hammer, but he never moved his body. He gripped the sides of the operating table.
"Control," he said through his teeth. "You wanted me to learn control, Jizz. I'm practicing."
He winced.
"Don't move," Baker ordered. "I'm playing it for laughs." "You're doing all right, son,"
Sam Quatt said, looking sick. He glanced sidelong at Gisbella's furious face.
"What do you say, Jiz?"
"He's learning." Baker continued dipping and hammering the needle.
"Listen, Sam,"
Foyle mumbled, barely audible.
"Jiz told me you own a private ship. Crime pays, huh?"
End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.